Hey folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Well, greetings and welcome to another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture podcast with me, your host, Damian Mason, and my co-host of the Business of Ag Success Group, Todd Thurman. Todd Thurman's a sharp dude. If you've not heard me and him talk on these podcasts before, I encourage you to go back and find the multiple episodes he's guested with me on. And as I said, he is also the co-host with me on the Business of Ag Success Group, an agricultural professional network where we meet every 2 weeks on Zoom. And we would like you to consider joining if you would, but that's okay. We're not talking about that right now. We're talking about something bigger. We're talking about profits of doom. And I'm spelling profits with both the PH and an F, the economics of dire predictions. Okay, you're saying, Damian, this sounds a little bit different from your normal fare here at the Business of Agriculture. Well, you know why? Because I'm going to go through a list and Todd is going to give his thoughts on this list because we've already discussed it about how many different things we've been told throughout our entire lives in this business of agriculture that turn out not to be true. And we're going to go back and take a historical perspective because as Todd says, too many times we make projections to the future based solely on historical data, not realizing there are huge adjustments to be made because of technology, because of human changes, patterns in the marketplace, etc. So we're talking about the economics of dire predictions. Why are these predictions so wrong? Why is it that we still adhere to old predictions that are already proving to be false or inaccurate? And what does it mean for you that operate out here in the business of agriculture? Todd, we've talked about this a lot. You kind of were the encouragement for me to throw this topic out there. So just give us your big picture before we get going into specific examples of the expert analysis and the misses that they have had.
Yeah, so I think there's a lack of trust in experts and expertise, and there's been a lot of hand wringing about that, and concern about that, and it kind of bleeds over into other issues where you're talking about, you know, people aren't trusting the science or not trusting the experts, and part of the reason that people don't trust the experts is because they're very often wrong. And so I think it's important to think through, you know, both some of the reasons why they're wrong, whether those are, you know, technical reasons that why they're wrong, or whether those are reasons that have more to do with motivations, which is kind of what you're getting at when you talk about the economics. So I think it's an important topic. I think we need to think through it. And my concern really long-term is that people decide to quit thinking about the future at all. And I think that would be a terrible result of these expert predictions gone wrong. And we'll talk about it towards the end of the podcast, but I think there's a different direction that we can go off that preserves our ability to, you know, continue to think about the future without kind of getting caught up in some of the problems that we're going to highlight today.
Yeah. So what I like is, and everybody right now, they're saying, hey, man, Damian, you always have some cool topics. You and Todd talk about stuff, but this is a little bit, you know, we're diverging just a little bit. And it's not because we're diverging into something crazy and it's not conspiracy talk. It is the reality that we in agriculture, more maybe outsized than any other industry, have seen all of these predictions and all of these experts tell us stuff that's just absolutely it's not only wrong. You almost wonder if there's been something, shall I say, conniving, that it's almost as though they were almost criminal in the way they did this. We started hearing this whole trust the science, you're a science denier with the whole COVID thing. And that got very dangerous. The reason that became up was because much of the human population felt like they were being manipulated and controlled under the guise of science and et cetera. And it does tie into what we're talking about here. You and I are going to go back a little bit in history. Let's start with the one that our industry, food production. Sure, ag produces other stuff, you know, fuel, clothing, cotton, whatever, wool. But in general, we think of ag, we think of food. The United States of America has the best fed population on the planet. We've had the most abundance of agricultural output for a long time. It's the basis for our economic greatness, why we still have 25% of the global economy. In 1980, under President Reagan, we rolled out the very first government's dietary guidelines for Americans. 1980, and it's been updated every 5 years. And I just want to give a few numbers. I talk about this in my book, Food Fear, and we are talking exactly about why, to Todd's point, eventually you start saying, those people don't know what they're talking about. We were a healthier country 42 years ago in 1980 when the dietary guidelines came out than we are today. When the government began telling us what to eat with new iterations of the dietary guidelines released every 5 years and then various updates within that, if you look historically, it seems that we have started to really take advice that looks like it's better for certain outcomes or better for certain vested interests. Okay, 1980, the dietary guidelines come out and they tell us to eat the four food groups and they should be this and this. And we keep changing them. In 1980, our obesity rate in the United States was hovering around mid-single digits. Right now, it's about 35 to 38%, depending on which stats you look at. In the United States of America right now, almost a full-blown 10% of us are diabetic. Back then, it was around 1 to 1.5%. In 42 years, you cannot tell me this is genetics. Todd's the swine consultant. You couldn't put humans in farrowing crates and genetically change our makeup in 42 years this rapidly. It is not because of genetics. It's because I believe the dietary guidelines, you would say well-intentioned. I would say almost not, because they were influenced by entities with a vested interest. I say the dietary guidelines are a great example of bad advice from experts. By the way, the dietary guidelines are created not just by the president. He says set them up. It's usually 11 or 12 or 15 academics that then get in a room and decide what Americans should eat. Your thoughts, Todd?
Yeah, I think it gets back to, you know, one of the sources of the lack of trust in science is the mixed messages that we get. And so what we talk about, you know, a lot of what we talk about, and we'll talk about it a little more in this podcast, a lot of it is future predictions. But part of it is also the research, and the research is confusing. And I think there is a lack of understanding among the general public, and more importantly, amongst the journalists, which are the dispensers of most of this information. And what they mistake data points as conclusions, right? And so that's why you hear this back and forth about, you know, coffee's good for you, coffee's bad for you.
Right.
The answer is not that necessarily the coffee is really good or bad for you. It's that there's different aspects of it and different levels, you know, that coffee can be good or bad for you. And the same thing with wine. But the problem is that we're taking data points from mainly observational studies that have, you know, less rigor than traditional double blind studies. And then we're extrapolating from that information a lot of times through a journalist about what the results of this study are. And so you read the journalism article in the popular press based on the study, and then you go back and read the study and you say, okay, well, that's not really the conclusion at all. The conclusion was there was a correlation here, not necessarily that we have an obvious causation or an obvious link. So two things being linked doesn't mean that they're causally related. And so I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes from, is a misinterpretation of statistics and of the way studies are designed and what studies are trying to communicate, and that message gets distorted by people that are less technical. And so sometimes the experts, not to defend the experts here, because we're gonna beat on them pretty good, but sometimes the experts are right, and the way that message is delivered it confuses the issue, and then experts end up taking the blame for it. So I think, you know, I hear things like, and I've posted about this on social media a lot, but I hear things like trust the science, and the science is going to do this, and the science is I'm not even sure what they mean when they say the science, right? Science is a process.
If you look at it in the last certainly few years from COVID on, if not sooner, well, climate change in general, we're talking about science means whatever you want to hold up as your reason for pushing your ideology. And that's where this thing has become dangerous. I want to go, by the way, dear listener, if you're saying, Damien, we're going to talk about dietary guidelines. No, I'm going to tell you, here's the several of the things that Todd and I mentioned. I should have started off with this. From the population bomb that we're all going to have, starvation, dietary guidelines in the United States, climate crisis, fossil fuel depletion, environmental Armageddon, silent spring, outlawing DDT, sunlight and sun exposure going to kill us all of cancer, eggs, red meat, economics, and then, of course, the trends that have never been that were predicted in my lifetime. So that's where we're going on this whole thing. Let's go back to the dietary guidelines. I talked about it in my book, Food Fear, and I'm saying again, it's about the money. Todd tends to be, dear listener, more accepting that maybe there's just some academic misunderstanding or misinterpretation. And I'm more the conspiracy guy. And I say, nope, follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. It's always about the money. President Eisenhower, back in the 1950s, had a couple of heart attacks. And I talk about this in my book, and it's worth noting. He died. He had a couple of heart attacks. Now, the man smoked four packs a day, and he had been in charge of the Allied forces in the European theater of World War II. One might call trying to defeat Mussolini and Hitler a pretty stressful job. And he's old, and he's a four-pack-a-day smoker. He had a couple of heart attacks, and he's the president of the United States. That could be stressful also. I mean, if you know what's going on, it could be stressful. Anyway, a little commentary there. His doctor said, oh, it's got to be the red meat. So this whole crusade about low fat really began in the Eisenhower administration. Well, it turns out if you look a little deeper, and an author named Nina Teichholz, I hope I'm saying that name correctly, wrote a book called The Big Fat Surprise. It released in 2014. If you read the book, she does a much better job of explaining this than I am, but I'll go ahead and summarize, if you will. The Big Fat Surprise talked about Ike and Ike Eisenhower, and this whole low fat thing was predicated on bad science. The study of seven countries, if you've not heard of that, a guy handpicked seven countries with low heart attack issue rates and went there and decided the reason they had low heart attacks was because of their diet. One of the countries was, I think, Crete in the Mediterranean. The reason they weren't eating meat and cheese when he was there wasn't because they didn't like it. It's because it was just after World War II. Their entire country had been blown into smolders. They couldn't afford meat. All the livestock got killed. Well, it turns out also, a bunch of these studies that came out in the 50s and 60s railing against fat and pushing the low-fat diet, some of it was funded by Crisco. Yes, the maker of Crisco, because in the 1950s and 60s, it wouldn't be not be uncommon that you would cook with lard or butter. Well, Crisco was the answer. It's a vegetable-based shortening. You can use this instead because it's lower fat, and therefore you won't die of a heart attack like Eisenhower just had two heart attacks. Turns out that was all completely bullshit. But you talk about the financial outcomes of dire predictions. So it's not as though these people are just mean and evil like Todd is defending them, these experts. Sometimes they get hijacked or they have profit incentive. That's where I'm going with this, Todd.
Yeah, and I think you can always tie that back to a narrative. I mean, if you think about the example you just used with the fat, that all goes back at the end of the day. I think the reason that has been so hard to shift that narrative is because it's very powerful and it's based on something that sounds completely reasonable, that fat makes you fat. I mean,
right. And if you buy something that's low fat, you would be less fat.
I mean, it even goes further back than that to the you are what you eat scenario, right? which certainly was, I'm sure at some point was very well intentioned. And again, it sort of makes sense. What you put into your body is kind of what your body turns into. But, you know, we know now that that's not really true, right? But that's such a powerful narrative that it's almost impossible to reverse that into somebody's mind. We talk about it in the pork industry. You know, trichinosis has not been a problem in the pork industry for, you know, I don't know, since I've been alive, right? Since my parents were children. And it's still, you know, it's a major problem in our industry is people overcook their pork because they're afraid of something that hasn't really existed in the U.S. in 50 years or more.
Yeah. Yeah, we haven't had a trichinosis issue in the United States pork herd since before I was born, and I'm older than you. And so we still think we had to cook pork to be shoe leather. So these things, now here's the deal. I don't know if somebody made money off of telling you you're dying of pork, but I do know it's historically documented that lots of entities have made boatloads of money by latching their wagon to the low-fat movement, which again was completely misguided and completely wrong. You don't die because of having fat in your diet. It's been refuted now, it's starting to in the last few years. The American Heart Association, I don't think, has changed their recommendation. And if you go to a normal doctor, by the way, doctors almost know nothing about diet. They've been trained on how to, you know, do stuff in a clinical setting, but they know nothing about diet. But they would tell you, oh, well, you got high cholesterol. It's because you're probably eating too much red meat or you're having too many eggs. That's not true at all. But that vertical knowledge still exists.
Well, and it goes back to a narrative around plaque in your arteries. And, you know, that's all sort of makes sense. I mean, it makes perfect sense. And it was repeated over and over again by people in white lab coats. And the combination of a message from authority and a narrative that just resonates with you, that feels like it makes common sense, whether it does make common sense or not, is such a powerful force. The combination of those two things, a doctor telling you something that makes sense, you know, just intuitively makes sense to you, is such a powerful message that it's almost impossible to reverse it.
Egg consumption during that whole thing, egg consumption has come back. I believe we're around 200 and goodness sakes, a poultry person told me this a couple of years ago. I think we're up to like 255 eggs consumed per American per year, something like that. Because you're saying, I don't eat that many eggs. Well, you do when you figure they're in the mayonnaise, they're in the salad dressing, they're in the cake, whatever. But the thing, Todd, about this is the egg production industry took a hell of a hit, like down 20%. We were down to hovering around 200 eggs per American during that whole narrative from the 60s. I think the egg consumption hit its absolute trough, lowest point, around the late 80s, early 90s, somewhere in there. And if you're a poultry person, feel free to correct me. I'm giving trend line stuff, not exact data points here. But that, again, was part of the misguided science, and then also the profiteering from it. And that's why, again, the economics of dire predictions. If you keep being told through the popular media the eggs will kill you, you're going to probably stop eating eggs. And as Todd says, intuitively, it makes sense. Oh, well, yeah, they showed me a little thing on TV where your heart your arteries get starting to get clogged up because of that fat. Well, here's the deal. There's a product that came about called egg beaters. And there's a product that came about called, you know, non-fat milk. So you can think about this as, are they just profiteering from the new marketplace or are they guiding it? And that's where the Crisco thing, when you find out the company that makes Crisco invested, paid to perpetuate this information. That's where I'm talking about the economics of dire predictions.
No, and I think, you know, it's a combination of both, right? It's a push and a pull. And I think a lot of times it's, you know, the companies that would argue that they're responding to a change in the market, right? People wanted lower fat products. And so they started providing lower fat products and they weren't necessarily, you know, they would argue that they weren't necessarily, they weren't necessarily supporting the science around what drove that market. They're simply responding to the market. I think there's a lot of truth to that too. It's where you get into, you know, the government starts getting involved. I think where it starts getting really confusing. And the reality is that the answer is not, is it one or the other? It's a combination of both. And again, that combination can create really powerful scenarios. And so I think it's, you know, if you start thinking of those things, you know, we talked about, you know, coming from a authority, you know, something that resonates, and it has to be simple too. And the reality is that real answers here are usually none of those things, right? They're usually very complicated because the world is a complicated place. And they're usually not simple and easy to communicate. So the real answer there suffers from exactly the opposite problem of what we described in terms of the narrative.
By the way, yes, the truth is we're not being any way negative about our fellow humans. But if it gets to be too complex, the humans are not really designed to handle a lot of complex information. You know, we were hunters and gatherers. oh, saber-toothed tiger, bad, run. I mean, that's it. Which brings me to the point of fear. If you look at the economics of dire predictions, those that profit or perpetuate their power, and again, I always say follow the money. Todd's a little different than me. I'm more out here. I'm the wacko conspiracy guy because I follow the money. Let's look at a couple of another examples that have impacted agriculture, and we're going to get to the ones that are impacting our future. The United Nations has a pretty big budget. It's an entire government, if you will. The United Nations, invented after World War II, was supposed to make sure that we had world peace. It hasn't really happened. There's been a war going on every single day of the time since the United Nations has been come into incarnation. Ever since, just think about that. The day the United Nations was invented, it was going to keep global peace. There has been a war somewhere on planet Earth, if not multiple wars, going on every single day since then. Warring tribes, it could be Ukraine, Russia, whatever. The other thing the United Nations needs to do is have relevance. You can't keep getting paid to go to expensive dinners in New York City and hang out in your office at the United Nations, which is on the east side of Manhattan, if I'm not mistaken, and some of the most expensive real estate on the planet that we pay for. The United Nations has to have relevance and they have to have a cause. They are, as I always point out, an activist group. You're saying, Damien, this doesn't sound like economics. Well, it sure as hell is economics. If you are a UN dignitary, you get paid quite well. You get hauled around in a chauffeured car in Manhattan. You go on expensive dinners. There's an economic incentive for them to always have a prediction of dire outcome. They are the ones, the United Nations has predicted that we're all going to overpopulate. The United Nations predicted we're all going to have nuclear Armageddon. United Nations now has shifted their dire outcome to climate crisis. I say that this is more about money. If you continue to predict dire outcomes, you are financially ingratiated because it justifies you as an expert or as an organization that somehow can change that outcome. Todd.
Yeah. And I think, we've talked about this in the past. I think one of the issues is the reward systems that we have in place, whether that's the rewards for who does research, or the rewards for who gets to go on TV and play the expert, or the rewards for which books sell, end up on the New York Times bestseller list. Those reward systems are not often at all really aligned with trying to find the truth or such and such. And so what you end up with is you end up with people that have careers. These narratives are so enduring that you have people that have literally built their whole entire careers around this narrative, and they become very attached to that. It becomes almost impossible for them to challenge their own narrative at that point because it's
their livelihood.
Their entire professional reputation and everything, and it's been built around that. And so one of the things that I thought is interesting is I dig into some of the research on experts and why experts are so often wrong. One of the interesting things that I discovered was that experts making predictions outside of their area of expertise were actually more accurate than they were within their area of expertise. And I think that's because they, have bought in to some of these narratives and have lost perspective in their own area of expertise. I had a dialogue with someone on LinkedIn a while back where I made a observation about the pharmacy business and said, man, there's something's wrong here, right? I sat there on the pharmacy waiting on my prescription to be filled and watched them work for 45 minutes. And I don't know anything about the pharmacy business, but I can tell you something's wrong. And it sure looks like an industry that's ripe for automation, right? And that was just all I put out there. And I got a really, in some cases, angry response. Well, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know about the ins and the outs. And I'm certainly the first to admit that I don't know the ins and the outs, but I have a perspective that they'll never be able to have because they're too ingrained in their industry. And I certainly am looking for people outside of my industry to make comments on that because I know how hard or how easy it is to lose that perspective.
First off, we're going to go way into that. And again, we're going to keep talking about the prophets of doom and the economics of dire prediction and dire predictions. Speaking of finding an expert, right now, if you are in the business of agriculture, particularly if you're in production agriculture, you're probably saying there's a few things I might need some help on. That's what I'm going to tell you about AgVisor Pro. My buddy Rob Syke, he is a Canadian entrepreneur who's always been in agriculture his whole entire career. He started a company called AgVisor Pro. It's an app on your phone. You just take out your smartphone. You've got one. You're probably listening to us, me and Todd right now, on your smartphone. You go to the App Store and find AgVisor Pro. AgVisor Pro is a community of experts with information. But you know what? They're not experts like these people we're talking about where they're trying to harm us by predicting crazy stuff. They might just be somebody that really has a great history of eradicating ragweeds or of fixing your planter up for better outcomes. And if that's what you're looking for, you can find them on AgVisor Pro. The point is, you can go on Ag Twitter right now and be ridiculed for asking a question by people that all are know-it-all dumbasses on social media, or you can go to AgVisor Pro and say, hey, I need a person that can help me set up my planter for better outcomes in these types of soils and this type of topographical and geographical area and climatological outcomes. By the way, you'll find this person on there. You can find them. You can be that person yourself. Go to AgVisor Pro and shorten your learning curve. More importantly, find the information you're looking for. It's on your phone. All right. You say something pretty interesting, that these people, if they are experts and they're predicting dire outcomes, I say it's about follow the money. They're increasing their profit or their power. We can talk about Anthony Fauci. We can talk about the guy that wrote the population bomb. Remind me of his name again.
Paul Ehrlich.
Paul Ehrlich is a professor, you said, at
Stanford.
Yep. And in the 1960s, wrote a book that was called The Population Bomb. It's the entire thing that then the United Nations hopped on. And again, predictions of dire outcomes to further your economic interest or your power or both. It became this whole narrative that we're all going to die from overpopulation. The United Nations perpetuated this for a long time. We in agriculture, this might be the one thing that we suffer from the worst. And on LinkedIn, Todd commented last week when a person went through that whole, you called it a tired trope. I thought it was really, it was almost poetic, Todd, when you said that agriculture has been sticking with this tired trope for so long that we're all going to starve. We have to produce more food in the next 20 years than we ever have in the history of world, blah, blah, blah. Just not even true. Go with that one.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a perfect example because, you know, here's a guy that ended up being just not just wrong, but spectacularly wrong. You know, I mean, not only, you know, he basically said that in the 80s that there was going to be mass starvation because we were not going to be able to provide enough food. You know, and here we are, this guy's still alive. I think he's in his 90s now.
And he's still a professor emeritus, and there's never been any accountability for his being wrong. And by the way, in the 1980s, we did have mass starvation in Ethiopia. But that's an issue of conflict between warring tribes, of supply lines being cut off, United Nations disaster relief failure, and political issues. It's not because we weren't growing enough food in Iowa. We had enough food in Iowa in the 1980s, just like we do now. And this guy was spectacularly wrong. Continue.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, not only, he was wrong. He said we're all basically going to starve to death. And instead, you know, obesity is the number one global health problem. We burn 45% of our corn crop for fuel, and we waste 40% of all the food we produce. I mean, it was just, you know, it's amazing, you know, how wrong he was. But, you know, if you go back and look, and I think this is where we need to start really focusing, is experts start being wrong when they start making predictions. And so we start blaming expertise and saying, well, these experts are worthless. But experts are very useful in terms of explaining what's going on now, what's happening now, and what has happened in the recent past. You know, I spend a lot of my time talking to clients of mine, talking about how did we get to where we are? What happened? How did the U.S. pork industry, for example, get to where we're at today? Well, I spend a lot of time anytime I talk about the future, I always go first and talk about the past and talk about how do we get where we're at today? Because there's a lot of potential learning there. And then, you know, why do we do what we do today? What are the motivations underlying the way we do business today? I get challenged a lot of times, especially with people from other parts of the world that ask me, well, why do you do it that way? Right. And a lot of times sometimes it's an uncomfortable situation because I'm thinking, I've never really thought about why we do it that way. We experts can be very useful in explaining you know, how we got to where we're at today and what's going on right now. They go off the rails when they start trying to make predictions. And that's where we really start beating up on the experts and saying, well, they don't know what they're doing because they made these predictions and they're, you know, they were, you know, sometimes hilariously, you know, way off. And I think it's a problem with not with the expertise per se, but with how we go about making those predictions and the tools that we use to make those predictions.
I'm going to go back to economics because I believe that humans always, they don't always do what's best for them because sometimes they do very destructive things, you know, with their relationships and their financials, et cetera, et cetera. But they make decisions generally emotionally, but over the long haul that they think help them. And so I'll go back to the economics, follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. Dire predictions do make you money if you are perceived as an expert. You were saying before we took our commercial break for AgVisor Pro that they become very siloed. All I've ever done is work on population studies, let's say, like the guy in Stanford. And so therefore, since all I've ever done is look at how population growth is happening, that's all I know. And so I'm going to stick with that. And I only talk to people when I go out for drinks that also do what I do, demographic studies, let's say. And so once you and me just agree with each other over everything, then you almost are never challenged. So you become very siloed, very insular almost, and you become economically vested in the outcome. In the speaking business, which I've obviously been speaking for 29 years, we used to make the crack. That guy is so full of himself and so full of shit, it's because he believes his own press clippings. You know, when it gets to where you see yourself as an expert and you see yourself as being incapable of being wrong, and then more importantly, you're like, wait a minute, my lake house that I have, the economics are such that if I somehow backtrack, I might lose my lake house. Damn it, I'm going to double down. So it becomes this doubling down, and I can go from climate change to eggs being bad for you to the population's going to all, you know, we're going to be dying in the street. Like, what's his fiddle there? It's the same thing. The economics of it are such that you can't backtrack because you then will be admitting you're wrong. You'll lose your expert status. And more importantly, you'll lose your thing. It's like Greta Thunberg and climate change. Her whole business is predicated on we're all going to die of climate change. It becomes your economic chip in the poker game.
Well, and I think one of the things that we've been able to show in the psychological research is that one of the things that we really respond well to is confidence, right? Confidence sells, right? So you kind of adding on to some of these, you know, themes that we've been already been talking about, you take a simple narrative, you know, a simple idea that makes sense and it's coming from someone that's respectable, that's wearing a white lab coat, and they seem really confident. Right. And so your confidence grows as your expectation, as your expertise grows. Right. And so that's, you know, one of the big problems is just this overconfidence that comes with expertise. And then, I think the other thing that we need to be thinking about is, you know, what are those motivations? What are those reward systems? Right. So, you know, I had someone tell me one time, if you wanted to grow your social media following, you had to look for opportunities to be, contradictory. You know, you had to, you know, find something that was, where you're arguing against the general trend in whatever the industry you're talking about. And I always thought that was sort of silly to go looking for something to be controversial about, but controversy sells, right? You know, nobody invites an expert to come on their television show to make a prediction that things are going to be pretty much the same in the next 10 years as they were in the last 10 years. I mean, that's just, it's not compelling. It's not interesting. Nobody gets rewarded for that. But more often than not, that's right. You know, the next 10 years looks really similar to the last.
Yeah, right, right, yeah. So it's funny, Cheddar News, which is an online outlet, has had me on a number of times, and they haven't had me on ever since summer. And that's when we were getting wet, we're getting hot and dry in the West, and the narrative that they wanted to put out there was that global climate change is going to cause crop failures and food shortages. And I went through, they asked me in a 9-minute segment, Todd, about 11 times, so this is because of climate change. And I said, no. And then, so we're going to have food shortages. And I said, no, the food prices in the grocery store right now are really high because of climate change, aren't they? I said, no, it's because of diesel. It's because of employees. It's because of demographic changes. they didn't want to hear, because the narrative was it's because of climate change. And I just refused to be that guest that was the doomsday predictor of dire outcomes. Let me throw a couple things at you. First off, I was laughing. If you were listening to this when you're driving on the road, you're like, is Mason over there chuckling when Todd's talking? It wasn't because anything Todd said was wrong. It's because he said confidence sells. Two things. He's right now visiting Thanksgiving weekend. His mother's there, and she thinks I'm too confident. And I'm like, honey, you should meet some of the people that I see on the speaking circuit. I always sit there sometimes and listen. I think, damn, it must be remarkable to be this confident for being as stupid as you are. So sometimes you hear people that you're like, my God, I knew a used car salesman that had a big ego and a big swagger, and he was a moron. You're up here on stage talking, and I think you're a moron, but damn, you're very confident in delivering your moronic outcome and predictions. So anyway, I was chuckling about that. Maybe you've had that too, Todd.
Yeah, for sure. And then one of the things that I think is a dig into this issue and try to understand what's really driving this. We have made a lot of the progress that we've made in agriculture is a perfect example of this by becoming specialists. And so we have, you know, even in the pork industry, one of the things that we've talked about is even within our industry, we have people that specialize in a specific segment of our industry.
Right? Like growing sows up till or gilts up to the time of breeding or something, like not just to say Farmer Brown had a chicken coop, 4 milk cows, a couple of a herd of beef cows, some hogs over here, grew some corn, grew some oats. Did it all. And now we're specialized. You've got people that don't just specialize in hog production, they specialize in gilt production or semen from boars in this operation. I mean, like they're specialized within a specialty.
Yeah. And that is, you know, that's great in the sense that is really, you know, driven our ability to become, you know, more efficient and some of the reasons why we didn't starve to death, like Paul Ehrlich was predicting we were, is because of that specialization. Yeah. But that comes with a downside as well. And you know, we in generating that specific expertise, we only have so much bandwidth, right? And so we give up some of that general expertise. And so, you know, one of the things that I definitely see in the agriculture industry, and it translates to other areas, is we have people that have very specific knowledge and are very deep experts, but we don't have a lot of generalists, people that are able to understand a little bit about a lot of different things. And again, it goes back to that reward system. You know, our system doesn't really reward that. But if you start looking at predictions and the ability to understand what's happening in the future, that requires a very broad set of expertise. And so a lot of times people use the fox and the hedgehog idea. And the hedgehog and the fox concept is the hedgehog knows one big thing, right? And he knows, you know, he's got really deep knowledge on that one big thing. And the fox knows a little bit about a lot of different things. Well, it turns out if you're wanting to make accurate predictions, having a broad base of knowledge, multidisciplinary base of knowledge, is a lot more useful than being a hedgehog and knowing that one big thing. And so I think that's part of our problem, is that we're getting smarter in the sense that we have deeper knowledge, but we're sorely lacking in those people that have, you know, that are generalists or foxes that have that broad-based knowledge across multiple disciplines. And that becomes a big challenge for trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future.
So, by the way, dear listener, Todd and I actually, since we've been hosting and producing the Business of Ag Success Group now for more than 2 years, and we both get paid to speak, consult, whatever, in the business of agriculture, we kind of almost would call ourselves expert generalists. We are not. He's an expert on hog efficiency production. I'm an expert on not any one thing. I'm an expert generalist, and Todd is talking about this exact thing. If you want perspective, we talked about the tough part. You get maligned, and we use the word attacked a lot in the media. And I'm like, someone disagreeing with me is not an attack. When the Japanese Imperial Forces blew up about 2,500 Americans at Pearl Harbor, that was an attack. Telling me on Twitter that they disagree with me or they think I'm wrong, that's not an attack. I think it's dangerous when you talk about these very siloed, insular experts that then it becomes their economic poker chip, that the only one they have to play is that they've made this big prediction. It's their economic, you know, viability. I guess the good thing about being a generalist like you or me, if I'm wrong about something, I always tell my audience, I'm telling you why I think this, and here's the data that I'm basing that on. But I could be wrong. And you don't hear that. Again, it's that thing. You may not get on Cheddar News again because you didn't tell them, damn it, yes, climate change, we're all going to starve. Climate change, there's not going to ever be any food grown in Indiana again. It's just not true. So instead of being the alarmist, I refuse to profit from the doom. Instead, say, no, I don't really think that's going to be the outcome. But it probably makes you and me less famous than we would have been otherwise.
Oh, I'm sure it does. And the opposite is also true. I talked about that confidence sells, a lack of confidence sells too. And the reality is if you're dabbling in areas outside of your, deep area of expertise, you're going to be less confident, right? You're going to be saying things like, well, I don't know much about the pharmacy business, but I do know that this looks stupid the way you're doing this, right? And the people within the industry are going to push back and say, well, you don't have any expertise in this, And what they really should do is they should listen and say, okay, well, yeah, you're not understanding all of these details, but your broader point is right. You don't understand why we're doing what we're doing, but the fact that we're doing this is really not a good use of our time. And so, I think that's, the exact opposite of that confidence. And really the research backs that up. It these areas where you have less confidence, that message doesn't get received as well, but it's probably more accurate. This is why experts, outside of their area of expertise are actually better at predicting what's going on, is because they have less riding on those predictions, right? So ironically, or I guess paradoxically, the more they have riding on that result of that prediction, the less accurate that they are. And it's because they lose that perspective.
Well, again, it's because they absolutely, their economic wagon is attached to it, period. They have to stick with their thing because it's like, hey, here's my entire thing is I'm going around Ralph Nader. If Ralph Nader came out, if you're old enough to remember him, he wrote Death at Any Speed. I think it was the name of the book about how the Corvair was a bomb on wheels and all this kind of stuff. If he came out all of a sudden and said, hey, it turns out the cars are pretty safe. It's not an issue. He's lost his entire, he was the car safety activist expert. So it's always that thing. They can't retract because it's their economic viability. Whereas you and I can say, hey, we're expert generalists. We talk about a bunch of stuff in agriculture and we connect the dots. And we willingly admit we might be wrong about this, but here's where we think this goes. Boom. Let's talk about what could really happen in the economics of dire predictions, what we should do in the business of agriculture and otherwise. You talk about a thing called strategic foresight, where we understand the future is unknowable and there's likely multiple outcomes. Nobody has done this at all. Let's just take climate crisis, because that's the one that we keep hearing about in agriculture. The cows are burping. We're all going to die. The United Nations is floating out again because they have to do fear and shock to have dire outcomes to justify their existence. The United Nations 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, came out with a big recommendation that meat consumption worldwide needed to go down, especially in those evil, wealthy countries like ours, because we're the ones who are creating climate crisis. And it was never, no, maybe that's not really needs to happen at all. But again, to justify their existence, they recommended that. You'd say, no, UN, you're just doing the thing. You're profiting off of doom. When the reality is, here's what we think, strategic foresight. What would it tell you about climate crisis?
Yeah, so strategic foresight is something I've been really interested in. I observed, especially in our industry in agriculture, that we don't do a very good job of long-term planning around business. And a part of the reason, I think, is what we've been talking about today. We've been talking about all these predictions that just go wrong. And so if you're sitting here, trying to run a business and you're thinking, okay, if all these experts are getting everything wrong, then how could we possibly be accurate in our predictions? And so I think a lot of times what we end up doing is we just quit thinking about the future. And I think that's really dangerous. And that's my biggest concern is that the reaction to all of what we've been talking about today is it's pointless. Just quit talking about the future at all. Let's not spend any of our time investing in the future because we never know what's going to happen. And we'll just deal with it when we get there. Right. And I think that's a bad way to respond to that. And I think the answer is to respond with a different set of tools. And that's what strategic foresight, argues for. And it's not about making predictions. In fact, one of the fundamental tenets of strategic foresight is that the future is unknowable. Right. There's too many variables. There's too many things that we just have no way of predicting that can have a major impact. But instead of saying, you know, OK, well, we're just not going to spend any time at all talking about the future, I think we need to be spending more time talking about the future, but in a different way. So strategic foresight says, OK, instead of trying to predict what's going to happen in the future, you look at multiple scenarios. Right. And so you build multiple scenarios that are plausible. You know, that's your standard. Not we think this is going to happen or we think this is highly likely, but that they're plausible. And so that allows you to build out multiple scenarios across a broad range of potential outcomes. And so the example that I like to use is we like to beat up on the UN about their population projections, and we basically say they're wrong. And I do think they're wrong, right? Yeah. But if you use that format and you say, okay, well, the number that you see there on terms of population predictions in 2050 or 2100 is what they call their median prediction. They think that's the most likely, but there's also a low variant and a high variant. And so if a practitioner of strategic foresight were to look at that, they would say, okay, well, let's look at that high variant model. Maybe that's less likely, but it's still certainly plausible. It's on the radar of the UN. It's certainly plausible. What would the impact of that be if that future came to pass? You know, if there were 14 billion people at some point in the future, what would that mean for my business? And what could we do to prepare for that or to influence that outcome? Same thing on the low end. And so now you're looking at three different scenarios that are all plausible. And by evaluating those scenarios and trying to understand what those potential impacts could be, you're preparing for the future in a way that's much more inclusive. And you're not saying, okay, this is what's going to happen and we're going to prepare for that. Because if you're wrong, and you're almost certainly going to be wrong, that's the only potential future that you've prepared for. And so now we're living in the future. We're thinking about the future in a systematic way. In a standard way, using a systematic process, but we're not narrowing ourselves down to trying to predict exactly what's going to happen. We're trying to evaluate a broader range of potential outcomes and try to understand what those impacts would be on our business and what we can do in order to prepare for that.
Agriculture is big one right now, and this is perpetuated on a daily, hourly basis by the United Nations and by the Greta Thunbergs, the activists, is that the dire outcome is climate crisis. They're starting to give up a little bit on the whole population thing, obviously, because it's hitting them so quickly that, oh, crap, with all this thing we've clung to forever, it's okay. So they're not retracting. They're just starting to back off on the whole PR campaign of overpopulation. And now it's all about climate crisis is going to kill us. Remember the United Nations, it was World War III was going to kill us, nuclear annihilation, overpopulation, starvation, and now it's climate crisis is going to kill us all. If you're using strategic foresight, Todd, I can look at the future and say, all right, first off, all you experts, many of whom are financially incented, again, follow the money, you expert scientists, get grants. And you get rewarded to keep studying meteorological things, climatological outcomes, but only if you agree with the narrative that climate crisis is upon us and we're all going to die. What if they keep talking about, well, we might be 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer by the end of this century. Okay, what if we are? And so using strategic foresight, here's the tough part. Nobody really knows. The sea level is going to rise and all of a sudden the entire East Coast is going to be underwater. I hate to say it, but if that's true, why did the Obamas go to Martha's Vineyard and buy a house that's only a foot above the sea line right now? Apparently they don't believe in their own gospel. And so I've got to say that the outcomes I see are if it's just a little bit warmer, and it's just a little bit more moist in Indiana, which it appears to be right now where I'm from. That's good for growing crops. You know, more water and a little bit warmer in Northeast Indiana, we're getting pretty damn good yields. I think that we are being bamboozled on the dire predictions of what a little bit changing climate might mean for us when agriculture is adapting so well, hybrids, science, biological products, et cetera. Your thought as you look at the climate crisis prediction and what we should really do as it pertains to agriculture versus what's being done or imposed upon us?
Well, we just talked about the UN population and their predictions. The only one you ever hear about is that medium prediction that they think is most likely. Or the higher. The IPCC reports are the same way. Nobody reads the reports. All they read is the journalism that's based on the reports. And all they report is that, you know, sort of, they have the same sort of thing. They have a median estimate, right? And so, but they also have a range in that IPCC report. So one of the things that we would do from a strategic foresight perspective, we would look at not just that average, but at, look at those extremes. Again, like I said, on the UN, you know, what would be the potential scenario there? What if that is what happens, right? And so we can start looking at preparing for what that looks like. That's a useful exercise, right? That doesn't mean we need to stop our efforts to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and stuff like that. It's a matter of being realistic about what is actually going to happen. What can we actually do? Let's be realistic. Let's think through these scenarios. And, you know, what does that mean, right?
But and the tough part, Todd, being realistic and it's kind of like you and I being a generalist. We're not going to realistic and looking at plausible outcomes that are not catastrophic. This thing's being overdone. Fear and shock sells. Fear and shock gets you on Cheddar News more often. If you'd say, yes, yes, climate crisis. Oh, my God, we're all going to die. That gets you media. And so we got this tough part that, again, you are incented and rewarded for dire predictions.
Yep. And so I think we have to, you know, we have to look beyond that. Use that framework, you know, that framework that exists there to try to think through, you know, what are these scenarios? And I think one of the basic mistakes that people make is when they're thinking about the future is one, they think things are going to happen faster than they do. Mm-hmm. Things happen almost always happen slower than we expect them to. So that's a fundamental mistake that people tend to make.
The average person, Todd, to that point, when you say, yeah, we've been doing agriculture for 10,000 years, that sounds like a long time because it is, because we might live to be 79 years old on average in the United States of America. When you start saying, well, this is going to happen in three centuries, like they can't grasp, you know, it's like trying to comprehend what 100 trillion is. You can't grasp it because we only live to be a certain amount of time. So we have to think it's going to happen sooner than it is because it makes sense to us. Otherwise, why would you care what's going to happen three centuries from now?
Well, and again, it gets back to, you know, what we talked about before is that confidence. I mean, the reality is what we need in science to be more accurate is modesty. We need to understand that we don't know nearly as much as we pretend like we know. This, I mean, you're talking about something as complicated as the climate. We don't understand, you know, we don't understand 10% of the variables that we would need to understand to really be able to predict what's going to happen in 100 years. You know, and so, but again, that doesn't sell. Modesty going, I don't know, maybe this might happen. You know, I'm 10% confident in something doesn't sell to anybody. Nobody wants to listen to a guy that's 10% confident. The reality is the people you're listening to are 10% confident. They just think they're 95% confident, right? And so, you know, we just have to keep that in mind. And I think that other fundamental mistake that people make is that human beings, what we've proven is that we're not very good at planning for things that are going to happen in the future, right? Preparing, planning for things that are gonna, especially in the distant future. What we are good at is we're very good at adapting. I mean, that's the reason we've been so successful as a species. That's the reason we're so successful. And so I think we should spend more time thinking about and more money and more effort thinking about, well, even if this does happen, right? So if we do have this 1.5 degrees Celsius, what is the potential impact and what can we do to mitigate those effects, right? Those are things that we're really good at. That type of process, innovation, adjustment, adaptation, that's what we're really good at. So the chances of us, you know, driving ourselves into a new stone age to prevent 1.5 degrees Celsius from happening is a whole lot less likely than us figuring out ways, you know, through technology and innovation to deal with the consequences of that. And then again, like you said, nobody talks about it. They always talk about that it's going to be an unmitigated bad. The reality is, and we've had a climatologist on the Business of Ag Success Group that talked about this. Some people are going to benefit from this climate change. There's going to be, you know, the guy that we had on in the Business of Ag Success Group said net benefit that Iowa will probably experience a net benefit to to in terms of agriculture for climate change. There are other areas that will experience a, you know, a massive, you know, decrease in productivity potential. Right. So understanding that that's not a popular thing to talk about. You know, that's not, you know,
if you, like I just said, my farm in Northeast Indiana, I already don't have to pay for irrigation. So I get a little bit more water maybe than would have been raining there 100 years ago. And it's what, 0.4 of a degree warmer on average during the summer, which is almost negligible. But again, I think that this is what, and of course, you and I'll get called climate deniers. And be careful, dear listener, of the economics of dire prediction are such that if your boat is pretty well only going to rise if your dire prediction continues to become the common vernacular, the common narrative, then you have to lash out at anybody that questions you. If you had told the dude that wrote the population bomb, this is not going to happen, here's why, he would have had to call you a population denier, whatever. So Todd and I are not climate deniers. We're simply pointing out that maybe these outcomes aren't really going to be all that dire. And also us in agriculture being used as the sort of, if you will, the whipping boy, my God, you're the reason we have cow burps, you know, all this stuff. You stand up for yourself and point out that maybe your predictions are wrong and maybe it's economically viable. And that's why you keep saying this. In other words, economically incentivized for you to say this. And if you point these things out, again, you're met with criticism. You're met with lashing out. You're a climate denier if you say, yeah, but your entire industry, your entire business of activism is based on predicting dire outcomes.
Yeah. Well, and the other issue there is that, ironically, sometimes you get more pushback when you take that pragmatic approach, when you're not saying like, this is all BS and, you know, this is not going to happen. It's all manufactured and, you know, whatever the actual, you know, climate deniers, the people that don't believe that the climate's changing or whatever, you know, you get less pushback if you take that position than you do if you try to take a practical approach to, yeah, hey, look, I just don't think Africa is going to voluntarily decide not to industrialize and to capture the benefits of industrialization because of they're worried about what's going to happen, you know, in the future with the climate. The reality is they're not going to do that.
Right. China's got 6 times the number of coal-fired power plants that we do. If I stop eating meat, is that really going to reduce carbon emissions when China's doing this? So it becomes an emotional thing. But again, I just keep looking at those groups or individuals that are financially better off to perpetuate doomful outcomes. And they are, and again, always look at someone's motivation. Why would a person, I'm pretty open book here. I get paid to go and get on stage and talk. And I probably could make more money if I did, oh my God, we're all going to die kind of stuff. I'd get on more Cheddar News interviews, but I won't do it. So always look at what someone is being incentivized to do. Todd says it's because they become too siloed. I say it's because they become too financially attached to their predictions.
Yeah. And I think definitely, you know, when you say follow the money, that has an angle that is nefarious, right? And that also has an angle that is fairly innocent. It's just, you know, we've created a scenario here that rewards behavior that is not really necessarily that productive. And not only that, disincentivizes behavior that is, you know, one of the things that we've talked about in terms of research, you know, what kind of research gets funded, you know, research from a scientific perspective, finding out that something doesn't work is just as valuable as finding out that something does. But when was the last time you saw somebody get an award, win a Nobel Prize for finding out that, yeah, well, that theory is not accurate. That, you know, it's not true. We didn't get the results that we expected. Another example, you know, you saw some of the crisis in the research. There was a group that went back and tried to repeat a bunch of studies and had, you know, shockingly low success at repeating those studies. You know, well, part of the problem is that the scientific process requires that, you know, that requires that to be repeated over time because there's variables that we can't account for. And so if you have a discovery that's been confirmed on multiple occasions, there's huge value in that scientifically, but nobody wins awards. Nobody gets grants to go back and repeat somebody else's study to confirm whether it's accurate or not. you know, and so that entire reward incentive structure needs to change. I don't think that is going to be easily changed. It's very ingrained in our systems and our processes. And so I think we have to figure out a way to navigate through that, understanding that those incentives exist, and trying to figure out a way to muddle through this and find the real value, the real information that we need to discover in order to be successful, despite these challenges that we deal with.
I'd say that you're still more of an optimist than me, but not too much more, because you just said it would require this and this, and you don't think it'll happen, because we all know you used trichinosis as an example. We used low fat as an example. Like you said, inherently, it just seems like it would make sense. So the problem is I'll keep going back to the whole climate crisis that's being really pushed hard on ag right now. And if you just so much as say, I'm not sure that it's nearly as dire of an outcome as we keep hearing, then you get lashed out and called a climate denier. And the tough part is these movements become, and this is the again, profit. When I said profit, as in with a PH, you've got people that now are experts and have esteem. They have credibility. They have fame by being predictors of doomsday outcomes, right? And so you're not only now asking them to change their prediction because it's wrong, or because you're now not only going against their economic interests, you're going against their pride. You're going against their once you're seen as I'm sure the 90-year-old professor emeritus at Stanford still believes that this is going to happen, and you can give him all the data and the reality, and he's still, because you don't want to knock him off of his prophecy situation.
Yeah, and it really does. It also, I think, something we don't talk enough about outside of politics. We talk about it a lot in politics, but we talk about this division. It drives this division. It drives the positions apart. You have these extreme positions, and one of the responses to that is to develop basically the opposite extreme position, to be a complete contrarian, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, instead of saying, okay, there's a huge population bomb problem, we're going to be overpopulated, the tendency is to come back and create the opposite scenario and say, oh, we have a major, you know, crisis developing that we're going to have an underpopulation problem. The reality is somewhere in the middle, but yeah. Somewhere in the middle is boring, and somewhere in the middle doesn't pay, and somewhere in the middle doesn't get you on TV, and somewhere in the middle doesn't get you grants. I mean, that's the problem, is the reality exists somewhere in the middle, in that moderation. And all of our incentive structures are for, you know, to push people to those extremes. And it's not ultimately, I don't think, productive, but I don't think it's going to change anytime soon either. And so we have to figure out a way to work our way through that. But I think the way we work our way through that is recognizing the reality of the situation and saying, okay, this is the way it is. What can we do? You know, in running our businesses, what can we do to try to take advantage of that? And I think that strategic foresight does offer us a path to navigate that without completely giving up on trying to understand what's going to happen in the future. And it allows you to occupy that middle of the road, at least in your own business. If it doesn't pay in terms of getting you on TV, being able to prepare for the future definitely pays in the business world. So where the incentives are.
Yeah, the incentive is in how you run your business, that you analyze what three plausible outcomes are, and usually separating the most doomsday-ish and maybe the one that is the least doomsday-ish, and somewhere in the middle is probably the right one. I love it. All right. This is a long episode. It was an hour long, dear listener, but it's also a good one because Todd and I can talk all day. Well, you know, what is interesting is that Todd and I have never actually even met face to face. We've been doing this for almost 2.5 years, starting way back when the whole COVID lockdown began. So I've got a prediction that his Texas Tech Raiders are going to play in the Guaranteed Rate Bowl December 27th in Phoenix, Arizona. That's my prediction. And if that's the case, I'm going to host Todd here in the Cigar Lounge at the De La Rosa West. That's the Arizona house. And I know that he drinks bourbon. I've got multiple. I don't drink the stuff myself. I'll have a Coors Banquet. He's going to have a bourbon. And we might just turn the damn camera on. we might just turn the damn camera on and you could just it'd be having drinks with Todd and Damian. And who knows? I mean, it could be the most interesting thing you've ever seen in your life. But that's only if his Red Raiders end up playing out here. I want to save that for last time.
Oh, sounds great to me. I might even bring mom along. That'll get really interesting.
Yes. And of course, Todd is a mommy baby, and his mom can then sit in the corner while we get drunk and talk about agricultural issues. And she can lash out once in a while and say, Damian, stop being mean to Todd. All right. His name is Todd Thurman. My name is Damian Mason. If you want to look up our Business of Ag Success Group, we would love to have you join. It's only $99 a month, and we have guest presenters just about every Zoom call we do. We do Zoom calls every other Friday. Great topics, issues, and you know that thing we talked about, connecting dots, being a journalist. Many of the people in our group are experts in their field, and the reason they joined our group was to broaden out, to not get so insular and siloed in what they know, to make sure they had outside perspective, and that's why you should do it as well. Look us up, go to DamianMason.com, find Todd Thurman, Swine Tex. Is it Swine Tex? Give me your website again.
Yeah, SWINETEX.com.
And also, Todd's very active on LinkedIn. He puts out really good stuff, so check him out there. Till next time, thanks for being here, Todd.
Thanks.
Till next time, it's the Business of Agriculture. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right. Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.